consult with various Bitcoin entrepreneurs with respect to their compliance and regulatory obligations. Early on, there were a lot of sort of tech anarchists and sort of rebels, if you will, in the Bitcoin space. And I like to think that they've since been replaced by entrepreneurs. And through that movement, we've seen a lot of folks come into the marketplace with various different ideas, products, and services, and fascinating business models. But you have to understand that this is in the world of financial services where there's some serious regulatory implications. And so I work with my clients to understand what the requirements are in terms of regulations and how best to comply with them.
What are some of the business models of the people you deal with?
Sure. So we deal with a lot of Bitcoin ATM operators. So just as the name might imply, it's sort of a take on the legacy ATMs, as it were, today, that are retrofitted to do a transaction into and out of Bitcoin. I also work with Bitcoin exchanges, much like a currency exchange. Maybe you'll see one at an airport or a mall. Very similar. In this case, they're all online, and they deal with the exchange of fiat or dollar-based currency for Bitcoin and vice versa.
Governments couldn't figure out what to do at first. They decidedly didn't like the idea of not being able to tax this trading that was going on. Regulation has started to creep in. Talk a little bit about the regulatory landscape now. What sorts of safeguards are there, and how does entrepreneurial behavior still happen in less than a Wild West fashion?
Sure. Yeah, so that's a bit of a misconception. There is quite a bit of regulation around the actors, folks that have entrepreneurial ventures within the Bitcoin space. So it's a veritable alphabet soup, if you will, of government agencies that are involved. We have FinCEN, which is Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. It's an arm of the U.S. Treasury. They enforce Bitcoin exchanges and ATMs and other means of getting into and out of Bitcoin, and they interpret that activity as money transmitter activity. We also have the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, or CFTC, that has said in certain cases Bitcoin is a commodity.
Not a security, but a commodity.
A commodity, right. It's funny you mentioned securities. The SEC has also weighed in certain circumstances. Bitcoin, depending on how it is offered, could be considered a security. And then for tax purposes, the IRS has said Bitcoin is property. And so I joke with my clients and friends in the industry, anytime someone asks, well, which is it? I say all of the above.
Obviously, you can do business anywhere because it's an online business and a consulting business. You've chosen to live in Bloomington Normal. Why? What makes Bloomington Normal great for a Bitcoin entrepreneur?
That's a great question. No, it's actually a great location. I tell my clients that I'm halfway between St. Louis and Chicago, both of which are really strong markets for the Bitcoin and the payment space. And I really enjoy the quality of life here in Bloomington Normal. So that's kept me anchored down here.
What kinds of businesses use Bitcoin?
Merchants could accept Bitcoin. There are tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands at this point internationally, of merchants that accept Bitcoin. It's a great way to avoid chargebacks, which I know is something of a four-letter word in the area of retail. So you can avoid chargebacks. The swipe fee is not there as it would be for a credit card, where you could pay, in some cases I've heard, up to 3% per transaction goes to the credit card company and the various institutions involved in that transaction. So there's an obvious benefit for retailers to accept Bitcoin, and not to mention it opens you up to a new population of prospective customers that may not necessarily have used your services before. So Overstock.com is a great example. They would readily admit that they have appealed towards a more female audience in terms of where they position themselves in the marketplace. By opening up to techies and to folks that may not necessarily fit their profile for a customer, they've really introduced a new set of customers that wouldn't otherwise use their services. So retail would definitely benefit. I think the best area that Bitcoin is suited for is international remittances, because the system we have now just doesn't work. It's broken. You're waiting, in some cases, 5 to 7 days to send a transaction somewhere else in the world. And when we have a very globalized society, we have a lot of immigrants sending money home to families. They have to rely on a system of many different actors and place their trust in those actors in that system in order to send funds home. And not to mention the exorbitant rates that in some cases they're charged for that service, when in fact they can do it instantaneously from their smartphone using Bitcoin.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Joe Ciccolo, a Bitcoin entrepreneur and consultant, about the business of cryptocurrency. How much has use of Bitcoin expanded in the last 8 years, and how stable is it now? It used to have larger fluctuations in value.
Sure. I think early on it was something of an anomaly. I think a lot of techies were using it. There was a lot of reticence in terms of adoption by the folks that are in more of a mainstream situation versus some of the tech players out there who were living and breathing the technology. They understood cryptographic technology and consensus algorithms and some of those technical terms that were very difficult to sell to the average person. And I think over time, as we begin to see the utility and the application of Bitcoin, you've seen a dramatic increase in adoption.
Ordinary currencies are backed by governments. Some items are backed by bullion or some other good that it securitizes it. How is Bitcoin backed?
Bitcoin is backed by math. It's backed by mathematical principles. It is software. It's an open source program. Anyone can download the code and examine it. Several people have. There is no backing to it in terms of, obviously, government authority. It's completely decentralized. And so it's trust in the system and trust in people that are involved in the system. The number of Bitcoins will be capped at 21 million. It's embedded in the code. So consider that a mathematical formula. There's 21 million Bitcoin that will ever exist. There'll never be more. There'll never be less. And they're mined into existence on a predictable scale in accordance with the software program.
There is increasing competition in cryptocurrencies. China has begun to look at issuing its own cryptocurrency. It really didn't like Bitcoin all that much. And there is an Australian mining firm that is issuing its own Oz currency that is backed by gold. What is the competitive landscape for cryptocurrencies, and how do you see it developing?
I think in terms of participants, it's very competitive. But in terms of actual results, Bitcoin has the lion's share of the cryptocurrency market. There are literally thousands of what are called altcoins, the alt standing for alternative. So there are any number of Peercoin, Litecoin, Dogecoin, Dash. The list goes on and on. And many of these are just more pet projects casual interest. Again, Bitcoin had that first mover advantage. They were able to capture that lion's share of the market. You mentioned some of the other players involved in this. It's no surprise that governments are going to try to issue their own currency. I think we're used to a centralized system of financial services. People have joked that, one day we'll see Fedcoin mm-hmm. from the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. That certainly wouldn't surprise me. I think that there is a desire to get involved from government's perspective. I think what it really comes down to is we are going to have digital currency. Is it going to be centralized, decentralized, or both? Right. I think the model of having cash and money in physical form, as I'm sure many of us have experienced on a daily basis, when was the last time we used cash or how often do we use cash? In our daily activities.
Less and less frequently.
Exactly. So I think it's going to come down to a digital finance.
So what are the arguments for centralization and decentralization?
So great question. I think the argument against centralization is the intersection between the state and banking that we have now. So there is a lot of oversight of financial activities through the banks. There are a lot of voices within the Bitcoin community very concerned about the authority that the Federal Reserve has over our monetary system. And you can probably read in between the lines, if you will, in the original white paper that was issued when Bitcoin was launched, that there are a lot of overtones and criticisms of the fiscal monetary policy of this country, or sort of more pointedly, the market meltdown of 2008. It's unsurprising that there are those considerations. So that's sort of the downside. When you talk about having decentralized cryptocurrencies, you don't have any central actor involved. So there's really no appeal to authority. Depending on who you ask, that could be a feature or a bug. So there are definitely those considerations. And I think ultimately we're probably going to have a mix of centralized and decentralized. And it's hard to argue when there are different options out there for different applications.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Joe Ciccolo, a Bitcoin consultant, about cryptocurrencies. The pro is that it's secure and anonymous. The con is that it's secure and anonymous. There have been concerns by any number of governments about Bitcoin being used in illicit trafficking of drugs and other goods. How should people address that concern?
It's a very valid concern. Early on, I think Bitcoin was dominated by headlines about Silk Road, the online marketplace where it seemed you could buy anything under the sun that was illegal, among other things that you could purchase online. And so Bitcoin got a bad name right out of the gate. But I think as people began to explore it and really looked at the technology and looked at the ways in which it was being used, several governments, including the UK Treasury, has come out and said, look, we don't really think that Bitcoin is high risk for terrorist funding or other money laundering activities. And I understand that that debate is going to continue to go on. But I think the best way to think about Bitcoin is it's not anonymous, right? I think that's one myth we really have to dispel. It's semi-anonymous. So while you can see the transactional activity on the blockchain in terms of the address of the sender and the receiver, you don't have their personal information, their name, address, and social security number, which is obviously a good thing. We don't want everybody to have that public information, but you are able to see some attributes. And using old-fashioned police activities, law enforcement has been able to, in the case of Silk Road, for example, piece together that activity and be able to trace it back to the illicit actor, or ultimately trace it to a destination that is an entity with which can be served a subpoena.
The U.S. has said, okay, let's regulate it and tax it. Other governments, including several countries in South America, have tried to ban it. That brings into question the use for remittances, at least in those countries. How do you think the landscape among the various nation states is going to shift over time, and why, on the question of whether to accept Bitcoin?
I think it's going to have to shift to an acceptance. There's always going to be regulation there, and there should be. I think you mentioned in South America, I'll take Venezuela, for example, which is obviously going through an unthinkable period in their history right now where there are food shortages, and it seems like the government has lost control of the country, just to put it mildly. And we're seeing in that jurisdiction where energy prices are subsidized by the government, people are mining Bitcoin and collecting that reward, and they are exchanging it for food in neighboring countries and then smuggling it over the border. So people are willing to go to those lengths, obviously, to get food and water and things, the necessities for their family. But you can imagine that power, and how do you ban something when you have people that are willing to do those things, knowing full well that if they were caught by the national police force, what consequences they would pay for that. So obviously, that's a very stark example, but I think it illustrates the point that it's very hard to come at this from the perspective of prohibition, that it's better in the case of the U.S. to approach this as, okay, we need to regulate this. We're not going to make a judgment. We're not going to say it's good or it's bad. We understand that people have options. We understand that there's a marketplace that needs to thrive. However, we also understand the capabilities that this could be used by illicit actors. So let's put our heads together and come out with some sound and some cogent regulation that works for the marketplace. And I think that the U.S. and Canada in particular and the U.K. are just some examples of nations that have really looked at this from a very reasonable perspective.
Joe Ciccolo is a Bitcoin consultant. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.